I haven't seen you for a while.
You've been freezing.
We follow the warmth back. Yes. You all braved lightning and tornadoes to be here tonight. Tornadoes could have taken you off to Kansas. Not everybody is here, but it's beautiful to see you be together. We have a new theme for the month of February. Oh my God. It's almost March. Well, this theme was too high, too far out for us anyway, so we're probably not ready for it. The theme is, and did you make any sense of this? The drop that knows itself knows the ocean. What does that mean? What could that be about? Is that bewildering? Why do I put these things in front of you? Anybody have anything to say? Otherwise, you'll have to listen to me talk. Farid.
Yeah, is this consciousness aware of itself, another way of saying?
Well, it did follow that theme, so maybe there's a relationship. Yeah. Yes.
Which, for me, is a very, very momentary thing.
Consciousness aware of itself, be careful, is not self-consciousness and thinking, oh, I'm thinking. Let's be clear about that. Consciousness aware of itself is a field in which the knower and the known are united. A field of consciousness in which the knower and the known, which can be yourself in the sense of yourself, that is Farid, the person who has a certain narrative and, you know, a certain social security number, etc., is known by the knower, that is, knowing through Farid or your essential awakened I. So we have this essential awakened I, the knower, and so often our consciousness, our awareness is out there, noticing what's out there, or even our thoughts, which is also out there, really, even though it's part of our internal processes, but our attention is focused on things, even if those things are thoughts and feelings. They could be hot dogs, they could be clouds. But when the whole of it becomes a field of knowing, that's a little different. And you're working to increase that capacity and be at home in it so that it's your natural state. So sometimes these ideas and the way they're expressed, words are wonderful and also limited. But let's just be sure that we're not talking about just thinking about thinking, for instance, which is both on the same level. Like A thinks something and B notices, thinks about what A thought and B comments on what A thought and A then comments on what B thought. Then C enters in and comments on both and you say, like making a decision, well, should I do this? But another voice pops up, well, if you do that, then you won't be able to do this. And that's all on one level and not the level we're working to awaken. So, in the realm of metaphysics, of Sufi metaphysics, which sometimes is expressed through poetry, in poetic form, the great poet Yunus Emre, the great Turkish 13th century Turkish, the great Turkish shepherd of the 13th century, literally he was a shepherd. He had a tiny vocabulary. He was like ignorant. But he was the greatest poet ever in the Turkish language before or since. He spoke of the drop that contains the ocean, not the drop that dissolves in the ocean. So today it's easy to understand because we have holograms and such, you know. We know that a hologram of the portion can reflect the whole. Right? So in Sufi Islamic metaphysics, we have so many things that point to this. For instance, in our tradition, God says, the heavens and the earth cannot contain me. We know the galaxies, how many billion galaxies there are, how many billion stars in a galaxy, and how many billion galaxies, and it's just unbelievable. And yet, the divine, if we trust it, is saying, no, all that can't contain me. Only the heart of my faithful servant, the knower, is expansive enough to contain me. So it's a very high truth. And on the one hand, it may seem very distant from our experience. It may seem like something that mystics talk about. And one day, maybe one out of a million people will realize it. You think that's true? How will it be realized? Who will realize it? Who will know that? And how? A drop that knows itself knows the ocean. Well, in a way it's really simple. I mean, there's some teachings that can be offered that I think once you hear, you never forget. That is that all of the qualities, energies, capacities, functions that are in the human being, such as consciousness, such as love, such as will. Let's just stop there before we get more confused. Consciousness, love, and will, those three things. They don't reside in, they don't originate in this physical organism, this piece of meat, if I may say so. The teaching is that all of these things, these and more, are sourced in divine reality, sourced in God, if you like, sourced in the source, capital S. So consciousness that arises in you or me, and love that arises in you or me, even will, the capacity for conscious choice, real will, the capacity for conscious choice, is an attribute of the divine, an attribute of the source, that's given to the human being. So, right from the start, there's nothing. Everything that you are is of that ocean. You are the drop, but your consciousness, your love, your will is of that ocean. And it arises in you and maybe gets reflected or activated through you. Now, the work of spirituality is to improve that reflectivity, to activate those attributes more and more, because, you know, neuroscientists say we only use what percentage of the brain below? Very small. And that's just the brain. That's not even the immense soul of the universe. So, as much as and as extraordinary as the human capacity for expression and reflection is, it's just a tiny portion of what's meant to be, of what's possible. So everything that we do is to clear away the obstacles to that reflection, to open up the aperture and to unblock what's blocking it, to call upon that source to activate itself through us, in a way, prayer. And when we say prayer, we don't mean praying for something, except maybe praying for divine flow, divine consciousness, but worship, supplication, contemplation, meditation, glorification. These are all things meant to polish the mirror, to improve what the human being can reflect. Now, the fact of the matter is, and now we'll get into the psychological side of this, which is important, because the truth is that if we had just this awakened eye that we've just been dallying with in our meditation, if we had just this awakened eye, it would be relatively easy. But if we observe, we see that moment to moment, day by day, something else is going on in our psyche. And what's going on is that, you could express it this way, there are these false selves, or aspects of the lower self, if you like. But it's actually pretty good to call them false selves, because they're not real. They're creations of some misperception and misunderstanding going on within our psyche. And lots of ways to identify what these distortions and misperceptions are. But one way of talking about it is that, you know, as we discussed last weekend when you were with us in California, most human beings sort of implicitly believe that the purpose of life is to be as undisturbed as possible, and to basically be in control of what's out there, and to have things our way. And part of having things our way and being in control is to gain attention and not be ignored, to gain approval and have absolutely no one disapprove of us, to maximize pleasure and security, and not to have pain and insecurity. And then these false eyes go to work, you know, trying to establish this somewhat imaginary condition. Now, if you enter dervishhood, if you become a seeker, you, in some ways, if we really took it seriously, we would short circuit all of these ploys of the false self. You know, a dervish has yoked herself or himself to the cart of servanthood. A dervish has no fear. A dervish may have fear, but a dervish, the ideal dervish, chooses courage in the face of fear. He or she uses fear and threatening things to be an opportunity to summon courage and awaken courage. And a dervish expects to face difficulties. You know, Rumi says, pure gold delights in the fire, because it's only in the fire that gold proves that it's gold. All the dross, you know, burns away. So the ethics and values of dervishhood, which we learn gradually, sometimes painfully, through constant reminders and examples, can short-circuit all those false eyes. But when they're not short-circuited, when we are living in a world in which the false self rules, where truth is perhaps relatively rare, and where perhaps the majority of people are not consciously seeking in this way, people around us, and it's natural to imitate and think this is normal, people around us try to achieve those states of having people's attention, having people's approval, having security and pleasure. And when we don't get those things, we have strategies to try and get them, and those strategies are things like complaining, getting angry, being resentful, trying to control and manipulate others to do what we want. All really dumb strategies. Or another strategy is seeking, trying to please authorities. And or have the right beliefs. You know, be one of the true believers, a member of the only true religion, or the only true political ideology, or the only right political party. So this is all the nonsense of the false selves. This is what goes on, and to one degree or another in all of us. And all of these false selves hypnotize the awakened I. Just hypnotize it. Put it to sleep. Rumi talks about that too. He has a poem in which he says, you know, we're like someone who's come under the influence of an evil nurse that says, go to sleep, my darling. I won't let anything disturb you. We have to break away from all that. Rumi says elsewhere, how does he say it, you know, embrace insecurity, be at home amidst dangers. Rina says, sip the poison and give the sweet drink to others. So this awakened I has the capacity, and only this awakened I, this pure objective witness inside ourselves, it's only that I that has the capacity to relate to God. The rest is nonsense. It's unreal. Only from that awakened I do we have even the possibility of a relationship with the divine. But the good news, what's the good news? What's good about this? Yes, Rebecca.
I'm here.
That's good. Yes. You know, one of our teachers said, there is no God unless I am. On a little variation on the la ilaha illallah. There is no God unless I am. And earlier tonight, I was doing a little kind of a donkey work. I was cutting and pasting so I could, you know, have a reading for you. But I had to copy two pages and then carefully cut them and scotch tape them together so I could put them and get two pages on the one page that I wanted. And it just occurred to me in the midst of that, well, this is just donkey work. I'm there. I'm kind of like a kindergarten kid with my scissors and the scotch tape trying to make it neat for you guys. And I just noticed that what a pleasure it is to be aware in that moment, just doing those simple things. What a joy it is. For no other reason, to be aware for no other reason than to be aware. And to be grateful that that's possible. And what bottom line is, what it all comes down to is that the divine has given us this awareness. Remember, sourced, in the source, capital S. And how foolish we would be, how ungrateful we would be if we neglected even something this simple as our awareness and lived with presumption and heedlessness and just, you know, dwelling in an imaginary realm. We're probably, what we're doing there is complaining anyway. Like, famous complaints are, this must not be it. That's one. I'd rather be elsewhere. If only, etc., etc., etc. all that kind of stuff going on, which is clearly, when you hear that stuff, that's the false selves. But the awakened eye experiences itself in a world, and in this moment of existence, experiences what is and is grateful and appreciative for what is, no matter what it is. Just grateful and appreciative, no matter what. The dervish is grateful and appreciative no matter what. It doesn't mean, it doesn't prevent us from working to improve things. It doesn't, if we're in a freezing room, it doesn't prevent us from finding a way to bring warmth into that room. But we always begin with what is, appreciating what is, being grateful for what is. And then if necessary, we invoke the divine for what we truly need. Not necessarily what we want, as the Rolling Stones would tell us. You can't always get what you want. Nor should you try always to do that only. But it's always fine to ask the divine for something higher, for something better in spiritual terms. To aim higher and to, in making choices, to always choose the higher, even if there's risk involved. So you fail. If you fail, okay, you fail. You choose again. But you choose the higher each time. You choose the better. You choose the more godly. You choose the more conscious, the more holy. And for us, the word holy doesn't mean the musty smell of some false piety. All life is one and everything that lives is holy. Holiness is reality. The drop that knows itself knows the ocean. Because you are the ocean. You are potentially the drop containing all the qualities. You know. In our tradition, the first thing that the divine gave to the primordial human being, Adam, was consciousness of the divine names, which means consciousness, even if latent, of the creative powers of existence of the universe. 99 explicitly known in our tradition, but in reality an infinite number in their manifestation. But that's vested in the human being. Every attribute of the divine is within every human being, whether it's awakened or not. Maybe it's in latent state. Most of it is latent. Very little of it is called forth. But the complete human being, the insan al kamil, which is our orientation, what we are moving to on the spiritual path, is the full, the activation of the full spectrum of divine qualities, everything from absolute gentleness to absolute power. From mercy to strength, from subtlety to clarity, haq, truth. So all of our practices are to either remove obstacles, to increase our quality of being so that we can observe the false selves and re-educate them. Knowledge to re-educate them, recondition them. Power of observation, power of awareness to see how we behave heedlessly when we fall. When we fall. and the increasing awakening of being in order to just be here under all circumstances in constant relationship with the divine. And an extraordinary thing about the divine is, and you can go to the Gospels, you can go to the Quran, and you will find that the words in there, which you've been repeating all your life, are saying something quite extraordinary. They're saying Allah alone is sufficient. Need nothing else. It's miraculous. You need nothing else. The divine is at your beck and call. That is at the beck and call of your soul. Not your fantasies, not your ego. That's a whole nother subject, you know. But it's quite extraordinary. I promise you, if you go and look and reread the revelations, that is the sacred revelations to humanity, for us especially the Quran, you will find that the divine promises you everything you need if you cooperate with it. And this is not to be interpreted in terms of, oh, I can attain quantum affluence by my positive thinking. No, you can obtain the bliss and security of your soul by surrendering everything to that one. And that's what Eunice tells us. So I don't think we've ever read our beloved Eunice. Well, we have sometime. I'm sure we have. This is from our book. I couldn't find any copies of this on the shelf. We'd better get some more. The Drop That Became the Sea, by chance. Yes.
And then in a man, sometime after Eunice had lived, he was, this is blasphemy, and destroying them. And then he got to a page that said,
and
whatever his name was, Bob, will be throwing these papers away, and then he stopped.
That's right. He reads a line in Eunice that says, one day Eunice will judge Mullah Qasim. Having nothing to do with your brother Qasim. So it's called call him Mullah Akbar. I know you're going to needle him with that.
He'll text him tonight.
I'm trying to catch you before you did that. So, I wonder who should read this to us. Camille, you read it to us.
I have found the soul of souls. Let this soul of mine be taken. I've forgotten gain and loss. Let this shop of mine be plundered. I've passed beyond my very self. I've removed the veils before me. I am together with the friend. Let these doubts of mine fall away. My own ego abandoned me. The friend took everything I had. Those who give and take are friends. Let this language of mine be jumbled. I cut all ties and went to the friend I fell in with God. Let my poems be scattered. I became tired of two-ness and ate at the table of oneness. I drank the wine of suffering. Let all my remedies be thrown out. Since this journey of being began, the friend has rushed to meet us. Light has filled the ruins of this heart. Let this universe of mine be shattered. I have passed up dreams. I have tired of summers and winters. I have found the gardener of flowers. Let this garden of mine be dug up. Eunice, you say it well, smooth as honey. I have found the honey of honeys. Let this hive of mine be given away.
What in this poem might be remarkable to you, or interesting, noteworthy?
I find that this reminds me of when I was, last time I was at Bishara, we read Whoso Knoweth Himself Knows His Lord by Mary. And this poem kind of does the same thing, that it says something and then it clears it, and it says something and it clears it, and it takes your mind and it gets rid of it, basically. And so that some other part of you can hear what's being said, mm-hmm. and it'll claim to understand. But that's the first thing that comes to me. Mm-hmm. My mind just can't hang on to it.
Mm-hmm.
It opens up
another. Yeah. Very good observation. Hold that question, keep reflecting on it, but Fareed, read it to us in your voice.
I have found the soul of souls. Let this soul of mine be taken. I've forgotten gain and loss. Let this shop of mine be plundered. I've passed beyond my very self. I've removed the veils before me. I am together with a friend. Let these doubts of mine fall away. My own ego abandoned me. The friend took everything I had. Those who give and take are friends. Let this language of mine be jumbled. I cut all ties and went to the friend. I fell in with God. Let my poems be scattered. I became tired of two-ness and ate at the table of oneness. I drank the wine of suffering. Let all my remedies be thrown out. Since this journey of being began, the friend has rushed to meet us. Light has filled the ruins of this heart. Let this universe of mine be shattered. I have passed up dreams. I have tired of summers and winters. I have found the gardener of flowers. Let this garden of mine be dug up. Eunice, you say it well, smooth as honey. I have found the honey of honeys. Let this hive of mine be given away.
Sometimes I think that nowhere else in literature is the spirit of pure dervishhood as embodied, as fully and beautifully as in Eunice. And I say that full awareness that we are of Rumi's tradition primarily, and that's not to say anything, to detract anything from what Rumi's gifts are. Rumi offers us an exalted truth. He offers us extraordinary knowledge and a glimpse of extraordinary love. But in Eunice you have a feeling of what would it be like to be a dervish? Inside dervishhood. You know, I found the honey of honeys. Let this hive of mine be given away. You see how everything he's saying is sort of like there's something going on. He's in a certain state. And everything out there, including his hive, his everything that you would call mine, or in this case Eunice's, it's all sort of out there, it's all secondary, it's not what's needed, because he's in that state of awakened I-ness in unity with the divine, and all the other stuff that he probably spent his whole life trying to get into position and arrange and build and your own and, you know, blah, blah, blah. All that stuff. I've tasted the wine of suffering. Let all my remedies be thrown out. You know? All my body work, all my homeopathic remedies, all my antibiotics, all my vitamins and minerals and juices, fresh juices. You know. One in health with the soul of souls. But there's also something else that's really powerful and kind of sticks out to me in a few places. And it's perhaps the clearest example of it is since this journey of being began, the friend has rushed to meet us. The real agency here is the friend. You know, really, we're not doing very much. Yes, we have our practices, we have our disciplines, we have the container of our tradition. All this is very beautiful and absolutely essential. But the real action is coming from elsewhere. And then my own ego abandoned me. Well, that's reassuring. People are so afraid of surrender, terrified of surrender. And then one day your ego just leaves you. It's the easy way to enlightenment. God knows how it happens, or for whom it happens, or when. There's probably a long period of devotion and effort and sacrifice and pain and sorrow. The friend has never been absent. The friend has never not been arranging the details of your education. Now you have to go out into your life and your practice and do what you have to do. Yes, Paul.
How do you balance ambition and advancement? I have a friend, every time I mention Sufism, said if everybody was a Sufi, we'd have no advancements, that everybody would be in complete surrender, no ambition.
Well, obviously he doesn't understand the first thing about Sufism, I would say that. But it's also true, there's a half-truth in what he says. The half-truth in what he says is that the world is maintained by ambition and greed. You know, by personal ambition. The world is maintained by the heedless. To a great extent, this is true. The way Rumi explains it is that in this tent of material existence, some people do their postgraduate work in tent pegs. Some do their postgraduate work in making canvas. Some do their postgraduate work in making ropes. But only a few understand that the purpose of the tent is for the king to meet his beloved. But on the other hand, there's nothing... The reason I say this person doesn't understand Sufism is that the proper functioning of your intellect, your reason, your will, and your access to knowledge absolutely depends on the clarity of your mind and heart. You know, and this is why, historically, and in Islamic civilization, the medical achievements and even the scientific achievements were closely associated with spiritual knowledge and with people who had worked to transform themselves. It's not quite as true in our materialistic society today, but without a doubt, if you confer with the greatest scientists, they are all, in a sense, mystics, in that they take knowledge from the unseen. Yes, that knowledge isn't given to any idiot just, you know, indiscriminately. It takes somebody who has fashioned a question and devoted themselves to acquiring the foundational knowledge upon which that question rests. But the real achievers in science are people who didn't work this out by a tedious process of reasoning. They didn't build it from below. They framed the question with all the knowledge they had, and then the knowledge was given. So somebody like a Nikola Tesla, clearly a mystic, brought in incredible knowledge. And, you know, the people who have discovered DNA and, you know, and the highest discoveries in the scientific field were knowers. They were knowers, in a sense. So, what is Sufism? Sufism is the purification of the self from the hindrances that obstruct our true intelligence. There's a definition. The rest is nonsense. Other people say, oh, Sufis worship dead people at shrines. <You know? laughs> Sufis are otherworldly, passive renunciates, you know, who turn away from the world and live a parasitic life. These are the cliches. It's not the truth. Yes, Rebecca.
Speaking to that, two things came to me. One was when Adnan was here, I don't know if I mentioned this the last time I was here, but he gave us this version, it's a phrase, men ana anahuna. and a question and an answer. I don't know if I'm saying it right, but and the question was, who am I?
I am he.
And I am here. And he said this would clear the mind, because who am I brings one here, like waking up tonight, to the reality that we're here. Who am I? I am here. So by being here, what are you going to do with your breath, your body, your curiosity, and that it, by answering that question and being here, I'm just cutting this short, but it was like you could live forever because you were so full of that I am here-ness, and you wouldn't give up doing anything to discover whatever it might be, how to mow grass or invent a better light bulb, or be like Carl Sagan and listen for first contact, or
yes.
These things. And then as you were speaking, I thought of, I like the practice of Aikido and giving away space. This is what this poem reminded me of. They might say, that Moriyuki Ueshiba would say, don't create a thief and neither be a thief. That we're, by being here, we have this power to create and to give away. But no one can ever take my place. I mean, I might, you might have this chair, but you don't have me. You might have my wrist, but you don't have me. Which takes me to Sting. He has a song. It says, you might know my credit card number, you might know all these things, but there's a bigger, we're here, and we're creative, so we keep being here. I'm done with what I can say.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So the work of spirituality is to work on being, and to work on being is to increase all our capacities for attention, you know, for starters, quality of attention. Yes, there are other ways that a person might develop attention. You could develop attention in the name of greed, in the name of, you know, performance. But an absolutely free attention is always going to surpass those other kinds of attention, because a free attention is not coerced by anything and can be directed at will. And the human ego, contrary to the idea that it actually serves us, is often our worst enemy. And until the ego is under the command of the heart. So a person may develop some of these spiritual qualities and may have them without necessarily being explicitly part of an esoteric path. To some extent, it's our human inheritance, and some people are born with more of this. But, you know, when you've lived long enough, you see tragedies. You see people who are destroyed because they lack self-knowledge in some critical area. That's ego. It is urgent. I mean, self-knowledge, self-awareness, these things are not only for some rarefied poetic beings called mystics, you know. This is a human need, an urgent human need, to be free of the false self and to be aligned with the greater intelligence. And whatever achievements human beings make are one way or another because of that. But we can increase our receptivity, our awareness, our ability, and at the same time diminish the ego's claim on these things, which kind of makes it ugly. I mean, the ego's claim makes it ugly. Diminishing of the ego's claim makes the soul more beautiful, more lovable, less in conflict with others, more in service, less defensive. Amin, amin, amin.